Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labour MPs.
Kia ora and good morning everyone. Welcome to this edition of Red Alert Radio on Planet FM 104.6. My name is Maya Lubeck and I'm a List MP for Parliament for the Labour Party. And also today I am your host on this regular slot on Red Alert Radio. Now today I'll be talking with my guests. I have a guest on the phone and I have a guest with me in the studio. And we'll be talking about the abortion law reform. Just a really quick recap on the timelines that we've seen so far. In early last year, February 2018, Minister for Justice Andrew Little requested the Law Commission to provide some options on making abortion into a health matter. In October that year, the Law Commission released a ministerial briefing paper, Alternative Approaches to Abortion Law. A bill was drafted that would remove abortion from the Criminal Crimes Act and remove any statutory test for women seeking an abortion before 20 weeks. And so last month, what happened, the abortion legislation bill passed the first reading before Parliament and it was a conscience vote. So basically it means that MPs don't vote as a bloc, but they take their own personal vote and walk through the eyes or the nose door. The bill was passed. As a result, the vote was 94 votes for and 23 against, and that means that we're now entering into a select committee stage. There is a special select committee that Parliament has set up. It's the Abortion Legislation Committee, and it's going to be chaired by the Labour MP Ruth Dyson, and the deputy chair will be the National MP Amy Adams. Submissions have opened. They're open now and they close on the 19th of September, so there's still roughly about a week to get submissions in, and we'll give you the website to do that later on. So, but first I'd like to introduce you to my two guests here. I have Ella Shepherd in the studio. Hi, Ella.
Hi.
Thank you for coming all the way from Shepherd's.
Thanks for having me.
I get it all mixed up now. And so Ella is a politics student at the University of Auckland, and you're just on a break at the moment, so perfect timing for us. Ella is the chair of the University of Auckland Campus Feminist Collective, a very passionate advocate for women and for reproductive rights, so she'd be perfect to us for us to be talking today. And on the phone I have Terry Bellamick, hopefully still. Are you there, Terry?
Yeah,
I'm excellent. She's very patient with us. Terry is the the president of ALRUNS, and ALRUNS is the Abortion Law Reform Association of New Zealand, and Terry has been the president since 2015. And I understand, Terry, that you visited New Zealand in 2005, then immigrated and became a citizen, and did your LLB at Vic Uni, graduating in 2014.
That's right.
At same year as I graduated. Hey, never.
Hey.
And now, as Ella, you're very focused on feminism and reproductive rights. You both started very early on having that interest. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you both about the topic that we're discussing today. Now, just to start with you, Terry, I've obviously had a good look on your website, ALRUN's website, and there's a flowchart. The flowchart really outlines clearly that there's a very convoluted process at the moment for women trying to get an abortion. So I thought it might be nice if you just wanted to run us briefly through how it currently works, our abortion law in New Zealand.
Sure, we can talk about that. That sounds like a pretty good plan. So the way the abortion system works is basically the way it's worked for almost the last 40 years. And just to lay the foundation here, abortion is still in the Crimes Act. Yeah. It is illegal for a doctor to provide an abortion outside the law. It's also illegal for a woman to seek abortion outside the law, although that part of the law was taken out of the Crimes Act and plopped into the Contraception, Sterilization, and Abortion Act, which doesn't mean it's not a sanction. It still is. It's just a $200 fine instead of jail time, whereas the doctor would still get jail time for doing it wrong. So, or rather, you know, doing it outside the law. Mm. So, basically, if you discover that you're pregnant,
yep,
and you want to get an abortion, first you have to know whether or not you're in covered by the health system. Because if you're not covered by the health system, you have to go into the private system, which is very costly. In fact, someone, a visitor from the UK, just in the past year, fell pregnant here in New Zealand. And you know, fortunately, New Zealanders were really, really generous and gave to the give a little page for her, and she was able to get care. But you know, for a lot of people, that is a huge barrier, and it's a bad thing. Anyway, first you have to go to your GP. And you can't get into the abortion service just on your own say-so. You have to be referred into it, usually by your GP. Mm-hmm. So the GP, will either say yes and give you the referral, or they'll say no. They are legally entitled to say no under the conscientious objection rules.
Yeah, and can I just ask you a question on that, Terry? Because I guess at that very first stage, you said very clearly abortion is in a crime sex, so it's still illegal unless some of those specific conditions apply. So really, it's my understanding that quite often a woman will have to lie to get the care that she needs, because she has to basically say, I see Ella nodding here as well, she has to say that she's basically mentally unstable, isn't it?
Yes, that's true, but we haven't even got to that part yet. We haven't even got to the part where she's having that conversation.
Right.
Just getting to the point where she's got the referral from the GP.
Yeah.
That can take a number of weeks, and that doesn't even that wasn't even part of what got counted in the study that was done in 2008 that found that on average it takes 25 days between the day you referred into the system to the day you get your procedure.
Right.
25 days is huge. It's a really, really long time, and it's not good from the standpoint of, say, our other people in the OECD. So, but the conscientious objection is the right of a doctor to just say, now get out of here. You can get that, but not here. But at some point you'll find someone who will refer you, hopefully.
But hold on. So when the doctor says you can get it, but not here, is there an obligation to refer you to a specific place, or they just have
nope.
to? Right.
Nope.
So no help at all. You're basically just told not here.
That is correct.
Right.
And they don't have to tell you when you sign as a patient with them that they're not going to refer you to those services. Is that right, Terry? Like if they're not going to prescribe birth control, or they're not going to refer to abortion services, they're under obligation to declare that when you first become a patient.
I didn't know that. Okay. That's interesting.
That's just it, which is one of the problems with the current system. You patients have no way of knowing what their doctor's going to do until it's the go moment.
Yeah.
And that's the moment at which you really don't want to find out bad things about your doctor.
Right.
Anyway, so at that point, once you're in the service, then you've got a lot of things you need to do. You're going to have to get lab tests. If you want to get counseling, you can get counseling according to the law.
Yep.
Although some DHBs do require counseling.
Right.
Te Mahoe just requires it. So you have to go and get counseling. You have to get an ultrasound, and then you have to talk to two certifying consultants. Now, these certifying consultants are the ones who decide whether or not you get your abortion. You can't just decide on your own.
Mm.
So they can only approve your abortion if you meet the grounds in the Crimes Act. And those grounds are, it's the pregnancy presents a risk to your physical or mental health. The pregnancy is a result of incest.
Yeah.
And here I'm going to get into some really dodgy language here, that if the child is born would be seriously handicapped, or the woman is severely subnormal. And those are the words from the statute, which just goes to show how bloody old it is.
Sounds like kind of outdated language, doesn't it? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes, very much so.
I'm just looking at the timer here, and you know we're already a third through our interview.
My Lord,
no,
sorry.
No, you don't have to be sorry, because I think you've actually really shown very clearly that the current process is very convoluted, and what happens is that a woman ends up further along in her pregnancy than you know when she first decided that she needed to get something addressed. And my question would be to to either of you. Do you think that that timeline of delay is helpful because maybe people change their mind? What do you think, Ella?
No, I don't think so. I think once you're down that road, you want to get the procedure done. What the timeline of delays does is it discriminates against the most vulnerable in society. So you're looking at rural women, like in Christchurch. You have to travel to Christchurch if you live on the west coast of the South Island to get the procedure. Uh-huh. You're looking at poor women that can't have childcare to go to these million and one different doctors and procedures and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's not actually helping people make a better decision. It's just meaning that people that almost need the care the most prevented from getting the care.
Yeah. So, again, Ella, I'd be interested to hear from your views on the fact that, you know, in New Zealand we pride ourselves on equal rights for women. How do you see this kind of outdated legislation sit with that?
Completely. Completely. I was 17 when I first kind of got involved in abortion law reform, and I was horrified. I thought, this can't be right. This is so outdated. I'm missing something in my research. We say, you know, we're very proud to be the first country to give women the vote, and yet it's quite clear, like black and white in the letter of the law and the Crimes Act, this is a piece of legislation that discriminates against women. I mean, there's no medical procedure that a man undergoes that is legislated in the Crimes Act. It's quite clearly discriminatory. So I think New Zealand's almost a wee bit hypocritical in the fact that we say we're so pro-women's rights and things like that. And I think, Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't meet medical standards of best practice according to, like, international conventions. The United Nations has criticised our abortion laws when we report back to them. Yeah, so...
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, it's kind of flown under the radar, I think, a wee bit. It's been a bit of political hot potato. People don't really want to touch it, but it's quite clearly discriminatory.
Yeah, look, and a couple of things I picked up from you there. I think you made a very good statement that, basically the women have to go through a lot of those processes that no other person seeking medical procedures have to go through. This is a really different kind of process in healthcare. It's because it's not in healthcare, but for healthcare. The other thing, and I think that's an interesting point that not many people have touched on, because I had to actually read through some big fat material to find out, is that the United Nations Human Rights Council actually called on the New Zealand government early this year to remove abortion from the Crimes Act. So this is actually coming from quite high up, saying to New Zealand, hey, it's a bit of an embarrassment that you're having your abortion law sitting in the Crimes Act.
Definitely. Absolutely. I think it's kind of a myth in New Zealand that we have abortion on demand. I mean, that's not the case at all. If you ask most people on the street, I think they'd be quite surprised to hear that it's still in the Crimes Act. It's a wee bit bizarre that there isn't more of a hullabaloo being made about this.
Yeah, and Terry, I saw some numbers and figures on the website as well, and I think it is probably really interesting to see that, you know, restricting access doesn't actually stop abortions from happening. And if I compare, you know, New Zealand numbers to countries where, you know, it is not as restricted in the processes to get an abortion, for example, Holland, New Zealand has 14 abortions per 1,000 women. In the Netherlands, where it's, you know, been legalized for the last 35 years, it's 8 per 1,000. So, you know, again, countries with the highest abortion rates, South America, North Africa, where we're talking, you know, nearly 40, 50 per 1,000 women, they have the most restrictive abortion law. So that whole narrative of abortion on demand or making things easier so it'll be a slippery slope, that's actually not correct, is it?
No, it's certainly not correct. And you hit the nail on the head there. Places with more restrictive abortion laws tend to have not only more abortions, but also more unsafe abortions, especially in places like Central and South America. And consequently, they have much higher maternal death rates. This is starting to be true in a lot of the more restrictive states in the United States. And you wouldn't think that was going to happen in a developed Western country. But the way that the United States has been going backwards in terms of reproductive health and reproductive rights, it's all going into that mix that's resulting in more maternal death, especially amongst minorities.
Yeah, it's quite a scary thought, because, you know, not only is having
restricting access to abortion and having it in the crime sec, not only does it shame and stigmatize as women, but you mentioned women dying. So the statistics that I've seen is showing about 47,000 women a year that die globally every year from unsafe abortion. So it seems very wrong that not only are you trying to make women feel like a criminal, but actually so many of them dying in the process. It's really rather sad.
And abortion itself is 14 times safer than childbirth.
I didn't know those statistics.
If you were going on grounds, that's kind of a standing ground. I mean, it's true of all pregnancies and all abortions. So statistically.
Yeah, and also I'd like to talk a little bit about the consequences of any unplanned or unwanted pregnancies, because quite often you'll hear people say, look, that shouldn't be just a woman's choice, and this is should be up for discussion for a whole lot of people. But when we're looking at the consequences of these unplanned or unwanted pregnancies, the consequences really fall on the woman. I mean, when you're talking about things like job loss or loss of education opportunities or being trapped in abusive relationships, what do you see?
Yeah, and
life?
I think that's...
Oh, sorry. Or Terry, either of you. It's hard.
Oh, I was just going to jump in. That's kind of the point.
Yeah.
There was a study done just very recently in the States, a survey that showed that, folks who have sort of anti-abortion views also tend to have anti-feminist views, and they tend to be very much against women's rights. So, that not having reproductive rights has a huge impact on, people's economic, what their lives are like economically and whether they can support themselves financially. And that has been huge for women's rights.
Right. Yeah, Planned Parenthood has some fantastic statistics on their website about particularly the introduction of over-the-counter contraception and birth control and the gains that led to women. University attendance rates increased by something like 20%, dropout rates decreased by 35%, there were improved living conditions. It's so clear, the link between control over reproductive rights and like a woman's personal autonomy and economic and social liberation is, that you can't help but kind of equate that to abortion laws as well.
Right. Yeah, and I guess if we sort of, I'm thinking back of the debate that we had last month, and thinking about some of the comments that were made by the opposition MPs. I remember one specific national MP who basically brought it back to the rights of the unborn child, and we see that a lot, especially with religious groups, and that's what they're focusing on rather than the autonomy of a woman over her body. It then goes on to the rights of the unborn child, and I'm just quoting the MP now. She said, presenting abortion as a health issue was hypocritical and a cover for those who want to support it, and as the statistics show, abortion is overwhelmingly not about a mother's health, but a decision for lifestyle reasons. So what would you have to comment on that, Ella?
I think that shows, I mean, the New Zealand laws are so antiquated in more ways that you can count, but one of the big things for me is that it forces pregnant people into boxes. You have to say why you want to have this procedure because of these very like narrow parameters set by the abortion supervisory committee. So I think abortion is appropriate when someone is pregnant and doesn't want to be. So I think trying to justify and go, oh, it's okay in these circumstances but not okay in these circumstances, that sort of gatekeeping is really counterproductive. At the end of the day, if someone is pregnant and doesn't want to be, that's when an abortion is appropriate. So I think I think it's the principle of it. Getting into semantics isn't really going to help here. It's the principle of it. Either you trust women to have personal autonomy and make these decisions, in which case you legalize abortion, or you don't, and you don't legalize it. So for me, it's quite black and white, that kind of getting into those little specifics and semantics is not really appropriate.
So you don't believe there should be any rules with regards to under what circumstances it should be allowed, or the moralistic aspects of something.
I mean, the only criteria for me personally is if someone is pregnant and doesn't want to be, they can get an abortion. That's the only criteria they need to meet in my mind.
And I think, Terry, you'd probably be on the same line with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember here is this. I mean, they call themselves pro-life, but actually they're just pro-birth. We actually care about, you know, real-life families and living the kind of lives that they want to live, where they can take proper care of their children and fulfill their goals for improving their lives. I mean, we actually care about, you know, what kind of life children have after they're born.
And it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because some of the, you know, the people that are against this reform will say, well, you know, there's lots of people out there that want to adopt, so why not have the baby and then adopt out? I think they're missing a whole lot of the, you know, what actually happens in those 9 months that you're, you know, carrying a child. And so,
yeah, and at what point did women become obligated to become baby factories for other people?
Mm. Yeah, you're just a vessel in that case, really. But I think I also want to think about some of the comments that we've heard about the what has been quoted as extremely liberal nature of our bill. And one of the national MPs, and this stuck in my head as well, talked about the possibility of gender selection that I think people would take up on.
Let me jump in on that.
Yeah.
I can just sort of jump in on that one, because there's absolutely no evidence of sex-selective abortions happening in New Zealand. But, you know, even if there were, sex-selective abortions happen because of prejudice against women and troubling economic incentives like dowries. I mean, it makes a lot more sense to fix the problem by addressing underlying issues, sexism and misogyny. Because prohibiting sex-selective abortions is just force the patients to lie and force doctors to try and read their minds and or racially profile their patients. And I don't think many New Zealanders would find that acceptable.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, you know, what I heard a line once that said that no woman wants an abortion. They all want to magically be unpregnant. And so I think it is that whole idea that women might just choose it because, you know, they like to make certain choices based on it. It's very far-fetched, really, to me. There's also, you know, an issue on the Law Commission report, which basically, you know, provided for three options. And one of the options was, I believe it was option C. Yes, model C, where up to 22 weeks at the time, the Law Commission said that the decision was, you know, for the woman in consultation with her, you know, health providers. But after 22 weeks, there would be a different process for that. And that has been picked up by this bill, become 22, become 20 weeks. So I guess, you know, when Ella said previously, I believe it should be a decision for the woman, you know, to make without any, you know, boundaries around it. That option that is in this current draft bill does put boundaries around it based on the timeline. So have you got any comments on that?
Yeah, there's a lot to like in this bill. I mean, this bill's great, but I think people on the pro-choice side were a wee bit disappointed that it didn't go further. We preferred not Model A, which was self-referral. I think there's kind of concern over 20 weeks that it's a wee bit arbitrary. It's not really based on any medical best practice. And once you get to that point in a pregnancy and you're looking at an abortion, it's happening under pretty dire circumstances. This isn't an abortion for convenience, to use the side of the anti-choices. So I think adding in a statutory test at that late stage isn't providing any safeguards. It isn't actually adding anything to the care being provided to the woman. It's just increasing another mark that she has to meet and adding stress. The thing is, I don't think that 20-week cutoff is really adding anything, helping the procedure be safer.
Yeah.
It just seems to be kind of almost like a political addition to the bill to try and make it a bit more palatable and make it pass.
Your thoughts on that, Terry?
Yeah, I mean, Ella's dead right about, you know, pretty much, I agree with absolutely everything she has just said. Yeah. Specifically, you know, about, you know, this is not, you know, 20 weeks has no real significance medically. It's only significance, and actually this is something that Louisa Wall in her speech during the debate touched on. The 20 weeks comes from the Births, Deaths, Marriages, and Records and Something Act that requires that if the abortions after 20 weeks be registered as stillbirths, because stillbirths are registered at 20 weeks. But there's nothing magic about that either. I mean, we're actually outliers with respect to when we register stillbirths. So World Health Organization, in fact, you know, recommends that stillbirths be registered at 28 weeks, which, okay. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing magical about that 20 weeks. But it does significantly impact families, because if you get a negative diagnosis or a negative test, you know, right around that 18 to 22 week time frame, that doesn't leave you a lot of time to think about how you're going to deal with this, knowing that in just a very short amount of time, the decision is going to be taken out of your hand. I think people should have enough time to think about what they want to do.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the idea behind it is that there's a very small percentage, I think it's less than 1%, 0.7% of late abortions like that, and so it would be small amount of people inconvenience, but I guess those are the ones that are, you know, those are wanted pregnancies, so, you know, at that stage, you're making life so much more difficult for people in very difficult circumstances. It seems very hard.
Very much so.
Now, one other thing I wanted to talk about was the protest-free zones?
Safe access zones.
Safe access zones.
I couldn't think of the word.
Yes. Oh, you've done your submission already?
Yeah, I submitted it this morning, so I've done a submission on behalf of myself and also on behalf of the Campus Feminist Collective. I wrote a submission when you voted on it.
That's really good, Ella. Can I just, before you talk about it, because I think this is a really important point, I just want to mention, because I might forget it at the end, that submissions are open till the 19th of September. It's really easy to do. I'm not sure if you did the same, but you can go online. You go to www.parliament.nz. There's a tab there that says Get Involved. It says Make a Submission. It's very easy. Drop-down menu, Make a Submission, and then you see all the bills. And you can just tick the bill, right? Is that how it works? You tick the bill, and then you put your submission, and you basically indicate whether or not you want to be heard, because you can do it online. We will read it as a select committee, but then you can also come and talk to the select committee and verbally talk about it. So, yes, talk about the safe access zones, Ella.
Yes, so that's very exciting, and it's not an expendable part of this bill. I think David Seymour talked, he was a bit concerned about it in Parliament, unsurprisingly. But it's really, really important. As part of the Feminist Collective, we've been involved in a lot of counter-presences outside the clinic on Dominion Road in Mount Eden. The anti-choice protesters are really threatening and intimidating, and they harass women. And again, I mean, you just compare it to any other medical procedure. You don't have people lining up, you know, protesting appendix surgeries or anything like that. So it is really, really targeted. And what we don't want to see is a situation that's happening in the States where protesters follow women home and things like that. So that's really exciting to actually say you can still protest, but you need to leave they recommend 150 metres. You can still protest, have your little say, but it makes it safe for not only women accessing the care, but also staff that have to show up to work every day.
Of course.
It's really intimidating and horrible. And they say they're, what do they call themselves, like street side counsellors, something like that?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. It's like a complete farce.
Someone's going to change their mind right there on the doorstep.
Yeah.
Do you see this as a necessity too, Terry?
We recently submitted our submission as well, and I do see it as necessary, but we actually recommended a slight improvement on the way the bill is written. Currently, the Minister of Health and the Minister of Justice can make these regulations on a case-by-case basis. Mm. We think that this protection should be available to all abortion clinics from assent. Mm-hmm. So just make it across the board, because we already know that people are being harassed and intimidated in this way, and they deserve the protection of the law.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
That's good. I should have put that in my submission.
I think you're both covering it between you. Look, I see that we're very soon are entering our last minute of interview, so I told you it would fly past half an hour. Now, someone else I admire very much is Margaret Sparrow, who's of course advocating for women for such a long time. I know she's the past president of ALRANS, and she's Dame Margaret Sparrow, of course. She says you have to trust people to make the best decision according to their beliefs, their economic circumstances, and their family situation. Mm-hmm. And I think we've very clearly outlined from both of you, Terry and Ella, that's absolutely what it is about. You know, you give women a choice because they know best the situation that they're in, and nobody else ever knows exactly what goes on in another person's life. So
exactly.
This was Maya Lubeck, Labour List MP in Parliament, with my guest today talking about abortion law reform, Terry Bellamek and Ella Shepherd. Thank you so much for being here today and talking
to
us about this topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you.
Take care.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/RedAlertRadio.